legal writing. And so that's why I wanted to look at his brief. But don't you think that the more interesting question, apart from who's going to pay, who's going to bear the economic cost, is who is in the best position, if this burden is placed upon them, who is in the best position to prevent these things from happening in the first place? And isn't that the societal reason for the respondeat superior line of cases in the first place? Obviously, the child is not in a position to prevent these harms from happening, and neither is the predator.
That's right.
So as a public policy reason, it's not who can pay, it's who can prevent this from happening. Well, who is in the best position to make policy to prevent these things from happening?
That's an excellent point. And
Pete, you should have given me an A.
You know, you can get back at him.
But you'll have to declare a conflict.
Hey, I declare more conflicts than you do.
Let's let her answer.
I addressed that in the brief that I made to the court. If I could just quote from a minute, it's sort of gauche to quote yourself, but I don't know how to say it any better than this. If the Court of Appeals decision stands, institutions of trust all over Oregon will leave their policy manuals on the shelves, their screening systems intact, their supervision policies alone, and their insurance policies narrow. But if this court declares that institutions of trust must bear the burden of broken trust by one of its workers, then they will respond as does any enterprise facing strict liability for mistakes. Policy manuals will come off the shelves to be reworked, screening and supervision systems will be rewritten, and insurance policies will be broadened. If you can get it. And exactly, if you can get it. And I understand the issue that you raised, Mr. Chairman, and I absolutely admit it is a difficult one.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The way I read this bill, wouldn't it include a daycare center?
Oh, I think it would include all employers.
Yeah.
It would include not only employers, it would include principals that are not employing, mm-hmm. such as the scouts, for example.
Yeah, I've used an adjective to describe another bill in this room before, and I'm not going to bring it out again, but I don't like this bill at all. I think it's a terrible attack on victims. And, I've seen a couple of bills come through this committee that seem to not really care that the jury system is there for a purpose. We actually had one last night that I felt wanted to do something other than let the jury decide what should be the damages for someone's injuries. So I'm extremely, extremely troubled by this bill. And I want to thank you for coming today and talking about it.
Thank you for that.
And I have testified before you when you used to serve here.
Well, is there a
small world?
Let's invite Mary Martins James up.
I want to thank Mr. Clark.
But you can stay there if you want to, because we may have some dialogue.
Yeah, but I want to thank Mr. Clark for taking time out of his day at short notice to come on forward and do this.
29.85. You don't like this
bill. 10-6-year-olds. Mr. Chairman, if I could make just one other comment, and then it looks like there's more people in seats. By way of practical, helpful suggestions, maybe I could make one proposal.
Didn't you learn the rule about not trying to make a bad bill better?
Yeah, I never did. I never did. I spent too much time with Representative Mannix. And,
We won't hold that against you.
Picked up some of those habits. I would suggest that you consider taking the language that the employer agent intended to commit the intentional tort and replacing that with language that the employer agent posed an unreasonable risk of harm. In the situation I outlined for you before where there was a negligent screening, arguably not even that horrible negligence would be covered here, or that horrible negligence would be off the hook, because how did we know that this person intended to commit the intentional tort? If, on the other hand, the standard is, did we know or should we have known that this person posed an unreasonable risk of harm, then I think that at least what you've done there is you've come back to the basic standard of negligence, and you haven't narrowed negligence law as well. I think that is, at least as I read that, the way it's written, it would not only do away with course and scope law, but it would significantly narrow negligence law as well.
Kelly, I'm sorry. Would you repeat your...
In line 9, Representative, where it says that the employer agent intended to commit the intentional tort, I'm suggesting if those 5 words, intended to commit the intentional tort, were replaced with posed an unreasonable risk of harm, then you wouldn't have to get into the tortfeasor's mind. You could get into his background and find out, was this person unreasonable risk to begin with? At least I think that would clean that portion of the bill up.
Thank you. Ms. Earls?
Mary. Let's start with Mary.
Go ahead.
Chairman Shetterly, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to be here. I'm Mary James. I live in Marion County, and I'm an attorney. In my practice, I regularly advise clients on how to hire and train good employees and how to manage their employees and agents to accomplish the mission of their agencies or organizations and minimize risk. Employers know that they're responsible for the actions of their agents that arise in the course and scope of their employment. This proposed amendment protects employers from tortious conduct by their agents that do not occur in the course and scope of their employment, unless the employer knew or should have known that a bad actor was going to or was likely to inflict the harm. What this amendment does is it eliminates a newly created strict liability standard for employers, which holds the employer responsible for the torts of its employees whenever the employee harms someone that they met through the employment. That's the ruling in the Fearing case. This morning, I trained the Oregon Association of Child Care Directors, and believe me, when I told them about what the case law had done recently, their jaws dropped. These were people who care very deeply about their obligations to the children that they care for. They go to extreme measures to train their, to screen applicants, to hire the right people, to train people, to supervise them, to monitor their behaviors. They do everything they can to try to give those children a safe environment. And yet, even those employers occasionally have workers who manage through the contacts that they make in the course and scope of their employment to abuse children. What this proposed amendment does is to protect the employer from being liable when the employer takes all those correct steps to hire, to train, to supervise, to monitor people. It protects the employer from being absolutely liable no matter what the employer does. And I don't think that this case will make people take a policy manual off the desk, because they already are. They really do have manuals in place. They really do, the employers who are trying to do the right thing really are trying to make sure that their employees are engaging in the behaviors and the activities that they were hired to perform. And really what the case law did was to say, it doesn't matter if the actions that you're involved in are not actions that we hired you to perform. It doesn't matter if we have strictly prohibited you from engaging in these actions. If you engage in these actions to someone who you met and who you developed a relationship with in the course of your employment, then we're going to hold your employer accountable for that.
If I can, and maybe I overstate my case a bit, but getting back on that issue of the policy handbook, I think you could see employers tossing the policy handbook in the wastebasket, because they're going to say, why bother? There's nothing I can do to protect myself anyway. I mean, I'm sure that's not the case, but I mean, at that point, the policy handbook is good, but it's not going to protect the employer.
It's not going to protect the employer, and today employers said to me, well, what should we be doing differently?
Right.
I didn't have an answer for them, because if they're doing everything that they've been taught and trained to do, they're doing everything they can in good faith to carry out their mission and not to create the situation that occurred in the cases that Mr. Clark represented.
Okay. Representative Williams, I'm sorry, did we
interrupt your remarks?
Yeah.
Oh, just a couple of other things.
Okay, then we'll get everybody.
Currently, if the job is merely the vehicle for getting to know the victim, then the employer is liable for the assault or the other intentional harm no matter what. And I would safely and from experience predict that these cases will be cited and already have been cited in other instances not involving sexual abuse of minors. The day after the decisions issued, I was in a settlement conference, and counsel for plaintiffs represented to the mediator that these cases meant that the employer I was representing was strictly liable for the harassment occasioned between coworkers that occurred off premises because of these decisions. So they are not restricted to a child abuse situation or a grooming situation. In fact, the plaintiff's bar immediately latched on to the broader language of these cases and is pursuing that as a strict liability standard. So
let's go down the row. Representative Witt, Representative Williams, and Representative Lowell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I think that something needs to be done to provide some reasonable protection to employers, but at the same time, I think the dash ones maybe go a little bit too far in that they use the word intended. What I would suggest in terms of language is to leave the intended to commit the intentional tort and add the words or posed an unreasonable risk of harm and failed to take the reasonable steps. I like that better because it makes clear, number one, that if you knew there was an intention there, there's a clear liability, or if you were negligent and you knew or should have known that there was an imposition of an unreasonable risk of harm, then you should have taken some steps. I think that addresses the concerns that Mr. Clark brought up about the bill.
Do you want to respond on the fly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, I think that does address, although the way that I read the proposed amendment, it does not eliminate a negligent standard. The negligent standard for liability still is a standard that is recognizable. And so to the extent that you have Mr. Clark's example of someone who didn't conduct adequate screening or who conducted screening and chose to ignore what they learned, you then have a negligent retention claim.
But only as to... It does say that should have known the agent intended to commit. And I'm willing to think about that posed an unreasonable risk of harm, because there you may not specifically know that this person intended, and it may be hard to prove that in any case, but it may be easy to prove that based on a history that comes out only after the fact, that they could have found out if they'd asked when they hired that they should have known that the person...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Mertens actually went, I guess it's Ms. James now.
I
remember.
Wait,
I'm sorry. When you were Mary Mertens and I knew you then. But I get, Mr. Chairman, I guess she went on to kind of cover the concern I was going to ask about, which was the issue about its application to other cases within the employee-employer context, and you talked a little bit about that. It might be helpful for the committee, especially those of us who don't practice in this area, to maybe hear some other examples of the context you might see this being used in. And then secondly, just briefly to respond to Representative Witt, who just walked out of the room, these amendments were not proposed here as perfect. They were a framework for the purposes of having a discussion here today about what is clearly a very complicated issue. So I certainly, I'm not offering the dash ones. I don't think we intend to move the bill today. But these were offered as a framework to get the discussion underway, and I think they've served their purpose with respect to that.
Representative Lowe.
Thank you. I would, in order to help us think more clearly about this, and let's take out the highly emotionally charged context of sexual predation on children, maybe we could simply use the food deliverer person who fails to the pizza man who fails to screen the employee and turns out that he's done a lot of time in the pen for breaking and entering into houses and stealing things, and that person uses the employment as an opportunity to case houses. That's a simpler model that might help us think more clearly. But speaking to your questions about policy, whether or not it's a good idea to go ahead and have strict liability on the employer for failure to train properly or failure to screen or failure to do a good job in doing background checks on their employees, don't you think that the insurance industry would really prefer to have a body of law that encourages their employers to be responsible, because in being responsible, that's going to reduce claims.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lowe, actually, currently, that is the status of mm-hmm. the law before these cases,
yeah.
and that is that that employer liability policies do take into account frequently whether the employer has policies in place, whether they train their employees, whether the policies are effective, and that affects the premiums. I don't do insurance law, but I know enough about the employer liability policies that some of my clients have that makes a difference. That's different than strict liability. Strict liability says it does not matter if you did everything right. If you have the misfortune of having a person on your staff that you screened for, that you trained, that you educated, and they took a wrong turn and shot the person when they delivered the pizza to them, you're going to be responsible. Because as a matter of social policy, shouldn't somebody be responsible? Why not you?
But we have a dissent.
And
you still have to prove to a jury three things. You have to prove that the employee was acting within the time and space limits of her employment.
Delivering the pizza.
Two, was motivated, at least in part, by a desire to serve the interests of the employer. And three, that the actions leading to the tort were generally actions of a kind that the employee was hired to perform. You have to prove those three things to a jury.
Okay, but the pizza in one hand and gun in the other, don't you have that as much as you have the priest...
Well, it would only work if you used the hot pizza as an assault weapon. So.
No, but it's just, you know, obvious, it's a crazy example. But you know,
sorry.
The pizza in one hand, the gun in the other, the person opens the door and you shoot them, you are in part serving the
employer. If you could make that argument to a jury, then you're a better lawyer than I am. The argument that I can make to a jury in a child abuse context is, that pedophiles go in, they are doing their job, at least in part, initially, in the early years many times, for the right reasons. And then, and the studies show this time after time after time, then they begin to cross the line. And I would argue to you that's very different than the situation that we just outlined with the pizza, because I don't know how in the situation with the pizza you can argue that that employee is even in part motivated by a desire to serve the interests of the employer. You've still got the three-part test you've got to satisfy to a jury.
Crime of opportunity after a survey, after delivering, you realize there was something behind the door that he could get.
Sure.
Having been there a few times, Representative Williams.
I'm just interested, though, Kelly, based on that, in the Chesterman case, how was the, how did the court reach that three-part test in the Chesterman case? Because all he was doing, essentially, was driving from the place where he had inspected the piece of property for purposes of doing an estimate to a boat, if I believe, where he often liked to sit and ponder the universe while he drafted the estimate. And halfway in between that spot, he pulled up in front of a house he believed belonged to his girlfriend, and in the hallucinogenic state, broke in and raped a woman that he had never seen before. So, I'm not sure the cases are always quite so clear on the three points that you identified.
What the court said was, we're going to let the jury figure out the causation question here. There was some evidence that he took the chocolate mescaline so he could stay awake and finish the work. And the court says, basically, if the jury believes that the reason he took the drug was to stay awake and do the job, then we'll let the jury decide if the causation between the taking of the drug and the sexual assault is close enough to hold the employer responsible. Again, it was Justice Peterson, Justice Carson, Chief Justice,
right.
Who basically said, I'm going to let the jury figure this one out because this is what we have juries for. And he sent it back to the jury. He did not decide that employer was responsible.
I think Ms. James had a comment she wanted
just
to make.
One thought that, and actually in the case, what the court said was not that the sexual assault had to be motivated in part by the desire to serve. What they said was that you would have to, what Mr. Clark is suggesting, is that you'd have to show that somehow the person engaging in the tortious conduct was motivated to serve the employer, and that's not what the court said. The court turned the corner. It went one more step, and it said, you can show early years that this person is developing a relationship of trust and confidence. How is that any different than a coach or a teacher or a person working in an old age home or person working in child care, any of your people who take care of other people create a relationship with the people that they serve, the Meals on Wheels person. What the court went on to allow a jury to consider was that the sexual assault itself, because it came along after the opportunity created by the employment relationship to have a relationship with the individual, that was motivated in part. It allowed you to turn the corner, maintaining the motivation to serve the employer all the way through to the tortious conduct. No one could argue with a straight face, maybe not even Mr. Clark, to a jury that someone who sexually abuses a child is doing that to is motivated in doing that in any effort to assist the employer. I mean, only a lawyer could make that argument, and my knowledge in the law, only a lawyer has ever made that argument when they argued that sexual abuse of a client was actually done for some therapeutic purpose, and nobody bought that argument either.
Well, we need to wind this up. I honestly, this is just fascinating. Terrible cases to be talking about, but the issues are very fascinating. I was going to ask, Betsy, do you have anything you want to say?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries, and without going into detail, because I think you've heard a lot of that today, we're appearing in support of the intent of the -1 amendments to House Bill 2985.
I thought you might be on that side. Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make an observation that it's always interesting to hear how lawyers can come up with a different interpretation about a ruling or a statute that seems like it only has one interpretation, but there are many.
That's why there are so many of us.
That's exactly right.
Representative Edwards.
This has been really fascinating. I mean, there is a balancing here, and it's hard to figure out. You know, the cases that Mr. Clark gave us are, you know, extremely troubling. And I guess, you know, I'm not a lawyer, so I guess I'm trying to ask this question. I guess for me, the question is, do we do something now, which is before us in a bill? And wouldn't over time, because you couldn't really answer the question, given your specific case, you couldn't really extrapolate what another ruling might be, which is sort of what we're going to be judged in some ways, what we do here. I mean, it may be a pedophile, it may be something else. And I guess where I kind of get uncomfortable is sort of overriding or moving beyond what the court system ultimately may put even sidebars on what the decision was here. I mean, this is the first time, as I understand it, at least the expansion. Now, there will be court, I assume there will be lots of challenges, as you were describing, all of a sudden you're hearing the same thing and other unrelated, at least to these cases. So I guess as a policy decision for me, it's a question of
timing.
I mean, and which is, you know, 3 weeks old, or, and I don't know what the court, you know, we don't know what the courts are going to do, and I mean, I guess I tend to fall that a jury system does work, but on the other hand, I'm also troubled. I mean, it seems like maybe the pendulum swung too far, but won't the courts ultimately help decide where that pendulum should be? And in what cases? I mean, maybe, to me, I keep thinking maybe the pedophile, this is appropriate. But other cases, the pizza man with a gun, I mean, I don't know. I'm struggling with this because it's not an easy one. Good question.
Mr. Chairman, it is troubling, and I don't think probably anyone in this room more than former Representative Clark understands, but this is a legislature that meets once every 2 years, and like it or not, you know, we take the issues as we find them at the time that we find them, I thought this was a significant enough issue, not just me, but others as well, thought this was a significant enough issue of an issue that we at least ought to have a discussion about it before we adjourn and the law stays in place as it is, as these new cases have determined, and maybe in the end that will be our decision. But the idea was that, you know, we're only in session for a certain period of time, and that's the time we have to talk about these kinds of issues, and that was the reason I think we moved forward with bringing this up now. And frankly, we're doing it on, you know, technically the last day that we can do it in the House.
Although saved by the note down to the speaker, we do have an extension on this to give us more time. I sure don't want to come to a vote on this thing.
Yeah, absolutely not.
Too big an issue to try and handle all in one day. I would be interested, at least for consideration for next week. I think we'll have to have something back at least some thought about amending it, as Mr. Clark and Representative Witt suggested, either leaving in intended and then adding the posed an unreasonable risk, or taking out intended. I'm not sure which, you know, that would be one way to look at that, and that may not so much be a barrier, but at least a narrowing, perhaps, of the effect of this while still accomplishing you know, the balancing on in favor of some victims.
To the extent that it's possible, may I please request respectfully, Mr. Chairman, that if we do have some slight advance notice of amendments to bills that affect complex areas of the law, I could at least have benefited
sure.
from an advanced look at the case law.
Well, yeah, and I appreciate that. That's why we only wanted to do the overview today.
I appreciate that.
In fact, do you have the cites for your two cases for anybody that wants to write those down?
At least last time I checked, they weren't
published.
Yeah. Okay. Mr. Chairman, I believe, you know, and I thought I had them in my file. I have copies of both the slip opinions in both cases.
Let's get those out to committee.
And I'm happy to distribute them to committee.
I have them here, too.
Okay, we'll get those to the members.
They're not terribly long.
No, they're compelling reading.
They are, and I would also ask maybe counsel to pull a copy of the Chesterman case as well, because I think it's helpful to read that opinion in context.
Okay. Since we have Mr. Clark here, I assume while you posed the language, that still doesn't mean you would support the language.
The reason that, and that's true, Representative, the reason that I don't is I do think, with all respect to Representative Williams, I think that the amendments, they do more than just overturn the two decisions that just came down. What they do is they eliminate course and scope for intentional torts. That's what they do.
And Mr. Chairman, I have admitted three times, I think, on the record already.
Yeah.
I don't practice in this area. I will say specifically, it was not my intent to do more than that when I requested the amendments from Legislative Council. And I'm sure the former representative remembers that oftentimes we request in broad terms from Legislative Council what we want, and we don't necessarily work.
You forget I worked with Representative Mannix. I never had to work with Legislative Council.
One last thing, Mr. Clark. What was the ruling on both of those? Were they unanimous?
I'm sorry?
Were they both cases unanimous?
They were.
All right. Thank you very much
for
an incredibly interesting conversation.
Just with this here.
Cool. Close the work session on House Bill 2985. We've got to move on here, folks. Let's try and shorten up some time, but I don't think the others are they're all interesting, but maybe not quite as compelling. Let's go back to 3361. Do you want to see if we can find Representative Witt and Will?
And Representative Lowe disappeared.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Beyer, did you have some business with us today?
I was just thinking about the vehicle you were
Oh, okay. Something about assumption of risk, I think it was. Yeah. Something about relating to torts is what it was.
Mr. Chairman.
Let's see, we're in recess for just a few minutes while we find our members and...